of sun. Thank you for feeding all living things on earth. Thank you, plant kingdom. Thank you, trees and plants, for converting the sun's light into edible foods that we can consume and digest, and for providing oxygen in the air that we breathe. Good morning, water. Thank you for being 75% of our body. We are one, and we bless you and protect you because we cannot live without you. Good morning, animal kingdom. Thank you for your companionship, your beauty and splendor, and for your sacrifice of life so that we may eat and live. Thank you, great spirit that moves in all things. Thank you for our lives and for the opportunity to be here and to be of service in this sacred earth garden of life. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Hello and welcome to Shaman's Keep. Thank you all for joining me today. I have some wonderful guests with me. They've been on the show before, and they are two of my absolute favorite people because they love Mother Earth as passionately as I do. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about them in case you have not heard of Raven's Way Nature School. It's something that everyone should learn about and go in and take classes and learn how to live in harmony with nature. My guests are Vincent Pinto. He is a naturalist, ethnobotanist, wildlife biologist, and wilderness survival instructor. And he has been teaching people how to, groups around the country, how to go out and learn to live in nature in a sustainable way, and to learn the wilderness survival skills that could save their lives if they were ever lost in the wilderness. And he has years of experience with this, and he has set up a place in the Sky Islands of southern Arizona that is just fabulous. It's truly an adventure to go there. His beautiful wife, Claudia, is with us, and she has just as much love for Mother Nature as Vince does. She grew up in South America, in Bogota, and of course, she was at a high altitude there, 8,600 feet above sea level, and she was taught from early childhood the valuable lessons of being a part of nature and of protecting trees, planting trees, protecting nature. And so, of course, it was a match made in heaven when they found each other. And so, Vince and Claudia, welcome to Shaman's Keep.
Thank you for having us, Caroline.
We are delighted to be here, Caroline.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to have you on the show again. And I want to hear all about the things that you've been doing since, it's been almost a year, I think, since you've been on the show. And so, of course, I want to know what's been going on with you since then. But before we get into that, would you just tell our audience a little bit about the Sky Island region and how you decided to choose that area for your survival classes and all the things that you're doing?
Well, it's a long story, but I'll try to keep it within the time frame we have here.
Okay.
Basically, when I was a graduate researcher at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, I was studying Gould turkeys, an endangered subspecies of wild turkey in the Peloncillo Mountains, where Arizona, New Mexico, and Mexico meet. And little did I know, I was in one of the Sky Islands at the time. Well, anyway, I fell in love with the region, and years later, I came on a trip to the Chiricahua Mountains, nearly killed myself on an icy cliff in winter all by myself, and decided to make the area my home. In subsequent years, I learned about the term Sky Island, first coined in the 1800s by a lieutenant in the Army. And he looked out at some of the lofty mountain ranges here and saw that they rose precipitously from very flat valleys of grasslands and deserts. So he said they were rising as if islands in an ocean or islands in a sea, hence the term Sky Islands. So here we are in a region where indeed we have these lofty peaks separated from each other by intervening drier habitat of grassland and desert. And in the mountains themselves, if they get sizable enough, and many do, they go to over 9,000 feet, you have lush habitat and more mesic or moist habitat of at least oak woodland if not pine forest, and if not spruce fir forest, then the tallest, of which Mount Graham is the highest at around 10,700 feet. So indeed, you have a vast contrast in habitats here juxtaposed to one another in a really surprising format. And we're one of the most diverse temperate areas in the world. There are other Sky Island regions in the world. Think the Atlas Mountains in North Africa. Closer to home, the Great Basin Ranges, say Great Basin National Park in Nevada, and the Ethiopian Highlands back in Africa. There are about 20 or so identified Sky Island complexes in the world, depending upon who you talk to. Well, we happen to be one of the most diverse temperate ones, and the reasons are because we connect not only to the temperate regions of the Rocky Mountains, which come down through the Gila region in New Mexico and add influence like elk and beaver and trout up in the Blue Range of Arizona, but also we connect to the Sierra Madre region down in Mexico. So we do get things like ocelots and jaguars, albeit rarely anymore, elegant trogons and other tropical things, both plants and animals, that barely make it up here. We're at the northern terminus of their range. From the east, we get the Great Plains coming in and the Chihuahuan Desert, a higher, colder desert. And from the west, we get the warmer Sonoran Desert, one of the most diverse desert regions of the world. So really, we're in a fabulous area where you have the tropics meeting the temperate regions, and we have the most islands or mountain ranges within any of the Sky Islands on Earth. We have about 65 or so between the U.S., extreme southwest New Mexico and southeast Arizona, as well as in Mexico. And it's a stepping stone arrangement so that various animals can make it north and south, and conversely, and very confusingly to many people, it is a Galapagos-like arrangement in which certain species, like certain snails, spring snails, for instance, in the genus Soranella, get isolated from each other in different mountain ranges. So you do have both isolation and connectivity competing, and yet overall making it an incredibly diverse area for hummingbirds. We recorded 18 species. We have about half of the bird species ever recorded in the U.S., recorded in southeast Arizona. The most reptile species, including the most rattlesnakes, in all of the U.S., about 25% of the ant fauna, 180 species just in the Chiricahua Mountains, okay, of the U.S. and Canada combined, and perhaps the most bee species in the world. I could go on, a lot of superlatives, but you get the idea that we're in a very special place here.
Oh, it sounds absolutely beautiful, and I fell in love with it until you got to the rattlesnake part.
Well, you know, let me throw in two quick cautionary tales, cautionary to myself mostly. Within the last 2 years, I have both stepped on a rattlesnake, not barefooted, with shoes, but it was in August, so it certainly wasn't cold. It was a full-size western diamondback, one of the more dangerous species in the U.S., and it didn't move, other than maybe slightly. It didn't rattle. I jumped back, said a few choice words, looked at it, and it silently went off. Now, if anyone was bucking for a Darwin Award at the time, it was me, yet that snake did not want to envenomate me. If it puts venom in you, it's not going to be able maybe to procure a meal. And then more recently, this past spring in Mexico, so that would have been a very dicey situation had I been bitten, I had one go directly between my legs, and again, a full-size diamondback, it did rattle, and I was actually checking myself for bite marks, and I did not receive any. So two of my nine lives are gone, but the point is, rattlesnakes really don't want to bite you, even when you press them severely.
Yes, well, that's good to know, but it doesn't make me any more comfortable with them. You know, I live in the Las Vegas area, and I have some land in northern Arizona, and we have Mojave Greens out there. Are you familiar with the Mojave Green at all?
Yeah, now you say Mojave Green. Certainly the background color is normally kind of an olive drab green, and that
is one
distinguishing feature sometimes from the diamondbacks. But in our area, in southeast Arizona and the grasslands, we host the most virulent populations of Mojave rattlesnakes across their range. So while you wouldn't want to be bitten by a Mojave anywhere, you really don't want to be bitten by one down here.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, that's the one thing I fear out in the desert, because you have 20 minutes to get to a hospital if one of those bites you. And they're not large snakes, but they are deadly, you know. So, well, let's get on with what you teach, like the Stone Age, because I believe everyone should take a survival course, not the kind where they have to go out and conquer nature and, you know, survive in spite of nature, but the kind of course that you teach where you learn to work with nature and you learn that nature is your friend. Would you tell us a little bit about those classes?
Indeed. I think wilderness survival skills are certainly one of our mainstays here, and for several reasons. One, of course, is we teach you the various skills that may indeed save your life and the lives of loved ones or even strangers one day out in the wilderness. And we teach it from a nature-only perspective, meaning you have to find, process, and use only what nature provides you. So we're not dealing with modern fishing tackle or guns or survival kits from a store here. I tell people if you're into that, you can bring your equipment, but eventually you're going to lose it, use it, it won't work. And what do you do then? Well, you have to do, hearkening back to our hunter-gatherer ancestors, what nature provides you. That's what you have to do. And
yes.
So there is this straightforward kind of survival aspect of, hey, this may save my bacon one day. But then also, I say it can save your soul, kind of. And what I mean by that is, in a day and age where we're fraught with various technology, really assaulted by it, and our lives 24/7 go through TVs and computers and various gadgets, different types, where we eat non-natural food all the time, a lot of us anyway, here's an opportunity to connect to the earth directly. I know of no better way than to connect to living things and the spirit of them and the life within them than to actually have them help you maintain your own life. So when I say, for instance, twirl sticks together in a hand drill fire method or a fire plow method, I really connect to the yucca plant or the cottonwood or whatever it may be I'm using at the time, because it's actually saving my life. And that's a connection that's more direct than any other I can think of. So really, I do think of survival of humans, but also survival of the planet. Because once you know how to use those things directly from the earth, then you value the earth that much more. And in knowing it, you value it. In valuing it, you love it. And in loving it, you're going to protect it.
And the knowledge is also very empowering for women. We teach people about the wild medicinal plants in the area, which ones are useful and the different uses, like people used to take advantage of the natural resources in their communities before, and basically how to be empowered when you are out there in the wilderness, and how, with all this knowledge, to feel comfortable going out there and exploring, testing the medicinal plants, testing the edible plants, cooking some recipes from them so you don't have to depend so much from what you buy in stores, but rather from what nature provides. So from a women's perspective, it's very, very empowering set of skills.
Yes, it is. I quite a few years ago, well, I think it's been about 10 years ago, I took Tom Brown Jr.'s survival course. And, of course, he taught it in he teaches one a year out in California, and the rest he teaches in New Jersey. So I took the one when he was in California. And it was so empowering to know that with something as simple as a knife, and if you didn't have a knife, you could make one. But as long as you had a knife, that you could do just about anything out there. You could, and, you know, it survival was not so hard if you know what you're doing, you know. So I think everyone should take take a course like you teach. I would like to take your course because I would like to learn desert survival. That's something that Tom didn't teach. We were up in the forest, and he taught us how to make a debris hut and, you know, different forms of shelter. But in the desert, it's a whole different story. And I would love to know how to survive in the desert, because
you know,
there are things that... Oh, go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, Carolina, I just wanted to interject that you make a great point in that it depends where you learn survival as to what skills you take away. There can be very specific ones that are adapting you to various environments across the U.S. and the world. Well, we happen to be in the Sky Islands, as we talked about before, and one of the hallmarks of the Sky Islands is that as you go up in elevation, you continually change habitats. And an idealized view of that from a survival perspective is that you start in deserts, either Chihuahuan or Sonoran or both, go up through grasslands, up into chaparral, thick shrubs, then oak woodland, it's called Madrean evergreen woodland here, and then up into pine forest, and finally topping out again in the highest ranges at spruce fir forest. So really, when people come and learn survival from us, they can have the pick of a lot or all of them, And that's a significant advantage over many other survival schools in the country, as good as many of them are, is that we can teach you a wide range of skills that will adapt you to a broad spectrum of habitats.
Mm-hmm. That's what sounds so wonderful about what you do, is because you can teach for all ranges of altitude and habitat.
Exactly.
And everything. So, yes, that's wonderful. Well, I'm really curious about desert survival because there's so little, you know, in the way of trees and shade, mm-hmm. and you don't want to lay down on the ground at night because all those little bitty holes you see going down in the ground that look empty in the daytime, things come out of those holes at night, tarantulas and scorpions and all kinds of things. And so I'm like, how do you make a shelter and where would you sleep? You don't want to sleep at night on the ground. What do you teach as far as desert survival that way?
Well, in terms of shelter, of course, shelter could be a lifesaver. I tell people, you know, you think of your priorities, say 1, 2, and 3, they're often shelter, fire, and water in the desert. It depends what time of year and where you are exactly and how you enter the survival situation as to which might be the most important. But certainly I would say shelter tends to be number one. Why? Because if you're under the furnace of the Arizona sun at the wrong time of year, let's say in June especially, then you're going to succumb to its effects rather quickly and get heat exhaustion or heat stroke, and that's it. That's the end of you right there, maybe in combination with dehydration, mind you.
Yes.
But also, you know, it can be a fire, depending upon if it's winter or not, and you may have to build a shelter that incorporates fire because you could easily freeze in, say, the Chihuahuan or Sonoran deserts. It's not,
oh, yes.
not a difficult thing to do, despite what people may think. But generally speaking, if you're talking about a more crittery time of year, if I may coin that term, we're talking about building a shelter that is cleared on the ground. So you're kind of testing the waters and prodding and poking those holes a bit, though not literally, but you're disturbing them to see, well, something going to immediately come out, say a bunch of stinging ants, and going to get me right away? If so, you have to choose another site. So site selection is huge in solving
yes.
a lot of your problems in terms of creatures in the desert regions. In some regions, you're going to have bark scorpions, and others they'll be lacking. And bark scorpions in the genus Centroides, Centroides scopularis, they're the only really, truly dangerous scorpion to most people unless you have, say, a specific anaphylactic shock reaction to a non-dangerous species. That said, they are fairly numerous where they're found. They do tend to congregate together, and they're very good climbers. In fact, they even frequent old houses, say, in Tucson. So bark scorpions would be a concern. Rattlesnakes could be a concern. Stinging ants certainly are in most places. And this is the type of thing you have to consider. So if possible, if you do have, say, a few meager, those sturdy mesquite trees or ironwood trees or even Palo Verde trees, you may try to conspire to build a platform off the ground. Now, that doesn't solve the problem with, say, the scorpions, but it would minimize them, especially on a Palo Verde, which lacks bark under which they can hide. It's a very smooth bark species. So I would try to get off the ground. Now, what would you use for your shelter materials? Well, one thing that's in abundance in the Sonoran Desert region, in certain locations certainly, are saguaro ribs. Giant saguaro is the largest cacti in the United States, though there are larger in the world, and supporting its 30-plus feet at times are ribs, woody ribs on the inside, that when the cacti disintegrates and decomposes, they're left there, and they're very sturdy and mass. So if you're able to tie them together, say, with some limber bush and make a platform off the ground, that's going to be a huge boon for you. Ocotillos, thorny as they are, may also do the same trick, despine, though that would be a lot of work. And in lieu of all that, what you could do is fill in those holes a little bit, plug them, minimize the area in which you're putting your body down, and certainly try to put bedding down, let's say grasses and such. But the key is, and a lot of people don't realize this, you put that bedding down at the last second, okay? In other words, don't put it down at noon and then keep it there because creatures are going to flock to it to provide shelter for them too. So just before you're about to put your body down, you'll put your grasses or soft bedding down so it's not so peopled with other creatures, I guess. So there are a few
yes.
tips for building a desert survival shelters.
Oh, that's good to know. Because, yes, up in the Mojave Desert, we have a lot of the tarantulas. And I don't think they're poisonous, but they certainly are frightening to look at.
Well, you know, they are. I have to correct you on that. They are venomous. Now, what's the difference between poisonous and venomous? You would say a poisonous plant or a poisonous toad. Why? they don't have a delivery mechanism to inject the toxins into you, whereas something venomous, a la a tarantula or a rattlesnake, for instance, do have a delivery mechanism, let's say stingers or fangs in this case. And so in terms of the tarantula, the North American species, north of Mexico, are venomous, but not seriously so. It would be akin to getting a bee sting. So, and probably the only way you would procure a sting, a bite, rather, is by picking them up. So I tell people, unless you plan to handle tarantulas barehanded, and even then, you probably won't get bit. And even if you do, it's not life-threatening. Again, unless you have a specific anaphylactic shock reaction to it. The last thing to realize about tarantulas, again, only if you handle them or get really close to them, is on their abdomen, they have a series of hairs. You may have seen them. And they're called urticating hairs after the genus Urtica in the nettles family, Urticaceae. So what they'll do is rub their legs together and cast those hairs adrift in the air into the eyes of a would-be predator, say a southern grasshopper mouse, which is a predatory mouse. So really, it's just more a gruesome factor because tarantulas have so many legs, and they do have a bite and have big fangs. But only until you get into Mexico, Central and South America, do certain species become actually dangerous to life and limb.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to know. Okay. Well, we had the experience with the land I have in northern Arizona. We took a travel trailer down there to spend a few days. And we were sitting, let's see, what was it? We had something else that we were sitting up on off the ground. And we looked out, and it looked like the ground was moving. And I'm like, what is that? And we shone our flashlights out, and it was this masses of tarantulas, big black tarantulas walking around. And I'm like, oh my God, you know. It was really something I had never seen before. When I first moved to Las Vegas, I had heard that every so often there was a migration of tarantulas through, and the roads would be just covered with them, but I never saw that since I've been here. It was the only time I've seen that masses of them moving was on that land in Arizona, and oh my goodness, it took my breath away.
That'll give you pause for thought, no doubt.
Yes, and I'm like, oh, I'm never sleeping on that ground. You know? Oh goodness, the desert is very, you know, deceptive. It looks so empty and open in the daytime, but it comes alive at night, and there are so many things out there that, you know, you just aren't aware of. You think there's nobody out here but me. And wow, at night, there's a whole new world comes to life.
But I think what is fascinating is that via the classes that Vincent teaches at Raven's Way Wild Journeys, you can really start to discern which of those things are really a threat to you and a terrible threat and which are not. And when you really look objectively at all the things that could really, really harm you, there are very few. Most of the things out there, they are going about their business, and if you learn to identify them and you're educated to know how to deal with them and how to give them their birth, they really want nothing to do with you. And I think that, too, that knowledge becomes very powerful and very empowering because we have all these preconceived notions and all this fear that is ingrained in us. But once we start to, you know, get the education from someone as knowledgeable and as passionate as Vincent is about these topics, then you start to realize, oh, wow, okay, that's true. This animal is coming to eat or to hunt. It doesn't want to deliver the poison to me, etc.
Yes. Yes, I believe that most animals just want us to leave them alone.
Exactly.
And they won't strike or attack us unless they feel threatened.
Exactly.
So, yes, I agree with that. Well, I didn't want to get off on so much subject of what's poisonous and dangerous out there. I want people to understand about how to make fire and how to learn how to survive out there. As you were saying, Claudia, with the wild edible foods and wild medicinals. Now, I noticed that you teach four different kinds of ways of making fire. I only learned to use a bow drill. And then you have other ways as well, right?
Well, I found with various pyromaniacs across the world, and I'm certainly one, it sounds like you're one too, and so is Claudia, we all are, that there's kind of a personal evolution in fire making. you know, you may go through your hit your stride early on and be able to make a really cool one match fire, and that's a good skill to have. Though we really don't teach that here. What we do is without matches. And my first fire making technique was indeed the bow drill. And I remember my first set wouldn't make a spark whatsoever, but would make some hot dust. And no matter what I did, no matter how powerfully I used it, I thought I was strong enough, I thought the set looked good. Well, finally I showed it to somebody, and he said, well, where'd you get this, Vince? This guy had been around the block a few times with this technique, a friend of mine, an older friend. And I said, well, you know, it's some fire-hardened sassafras from a burned area in the woods of Philadelphia. He said, well, that's your problem. All the moisture was driven out. It's so hard. Nobody can make a fire with this. So I learned the technique and got good at it. From there, I went on to hand drill fire making, which is the one technique native to most of North America, whereas the bow drill is more like an Arctic or even Egyptian technique. So the hand drill being used in North America, Central and South America, as well as Africa. Once I became proficient with that, I moved on to a very intriguing technique that became semi-famous with the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks, and that is the fire plow. And the fire plow is literally rubbing two sticks together in the most primitive way. I joke with people, any more primitive than this, you're chasing lightning and volcanoes. but the other technique I learned, the fourth technique, is the fire saw, and that's more a Southeast Asia or Australian technique. And really, they're variations on a theme. It's all rubbing sticks together creatively to create hot dust that at a certain temperature, from as low as around 250 degrees Fahrenheit, studies have shown, up to maybe 750 degrees Fahrenheit with more difficult woods, you're going to have that dust spontaneously combust into a red ember. And I tell people, you know, that's what makes us human right there, the ability to make and use fire. And you may say, well, hey, in a modern day and age, where does that fit in? What about the combustion engine? What about your blender, which has a motor in it? It's all fire in varying degrees. So, you know, being able to make a fire and being able to be flexible in your technique and materials is huge. Without flexibility, you're a one-trick pony, and that's going to get you in trouble mighty fast.
But it is also fascinating to go out in the wilderness to some of these wilderness survival treks that Vincent teaches in various beautiful locations, and to see him garner whatever woods are available in that particular environment and make a fire out of those woods. So in a society like ours, where we're so dependent in our gadgets and where people think that unless they have matches and lighters and gasoline and so forth nearby, they're unable to make fire, to cook a meal, and to fend for themselves, it is very empowering, once again, to witness that he picks the wounds that are available and the materials and the resources that are available. And in a maximum of 6 seconds, which is really nothing, he's able to make fire. So it's really wonderful, and I highly recommend that class to people because it changes your perspective about really what's important and the skills that are empowering as a human being.
Yeah, and I have to just add in and back up what Claudia said. I'll use the same word she did. It is empowering. Of all the skills you can do, if you can do one, I would say make a fire. Why? It can signal rescuers as to where you are. It can give you heat, light, keep dangerous animals, particularly, say, mosquitoes and other invertebrates at bay, although large predators as well. It can smoke things. It can cook your food, on and on and on. I actually did my master's thesis on this. And so fire is a lifesaver extraordinaire. And if you can make it, you've done something significant, and that will save the day most likely.
Yes, I believe that because so much of what we do, it's almost like electricity. In the primitive world, fire was electricity, you know, because we use electricity for everything now, but fire was used for everything, as you said, cooking, making sure the lions didn't attack, and all sorts of things. So, yes, it's so empowering to learn that. When I learned how to do the bow drill and I came home from that class and I was so excited about it, and I was telling my son, I was all enthusiastic, and he listened to my whole story, and then he said, well, Mom, I usually just take a lighter with me when I go camping. And I'm like, well, fine, but what if you were lost out there for days and the lighter runs out of fluid? And then what are you going to do? This is something you need to know, you know. But, you know, our young people today are not So a lot of them are just not aware of how fragile our society is. I mean, they've grown up with it, and they think, oh, this is just the way it is, and this is the way it's always going to be, and all. But, you know, in a blink of an eye, and we've seen it in the last year or two with tsunamis and earthquakes and storms and things that have just wiped away everything, that in the blink of an eye, tornadoes that passed over Joplin, and there was nothing left. And we know that it's really a very fragile world we live in, this world that we've created and constructed, our man-made world. And
well, you
so
know,
to
Caroline,
know,
I couldn't back you more to the hilt, because it's a thin line we walk, and that line between everyday living and being cast into a survival situation is so shocking and surprising to most people. That indeed is why it's a survival situation. If you expected it, if you planned for it to the nth degree, it's probably not going to be a survival situation. And actually, I pride myself on the fact that I've never put myself in a real-life survival situation. I put myself in practice situations where I go out in the wilderness, where if anything goes wrong, I'm in big trouble, but I make sure nothing goes wrong. And of course, there's an element of luck always for anybody. But if you meet a survival instructor who's been in 10 different life-threatening situations unexpectedly, you may start to question, why do they keep getting in trouble so often? So it's circumventing that trouble, expecting it, anticipating it, and if it gets close, we've all been close out in the wilderness, knowing how to react to keep it at bay, those are the skills that really go a long way. And there's an old survival saying that basically goes, the more you know, the less you need. Well, the more you know about the potentiality of dangerous situations in any scenario out in the wild, then you're probably going to avoid it. You're not going to fall off the cliff. You're not going to be bitten by the rattlesnake. And you're not going to eat the poisonous plant as opposed to the wild edible plant. So, you know, those things go a hugely long way in keeping you out of trouble.
And the reason why Raven's Way Wild Journeys is so popular now is, Caroline, precisely because young people and people of all ages, as they see all the catastrophes that are happening and how their communities, in a blink of a second, can go from normalcy to disaster, they're really getting curious as to what is it that they could learn in their own environments to be able to know which plants to rely upon for medicine or for food, how to make fire by friction if they lose electricity and they have nothing to take care of their families for a week, 2 weeks, etc. And so people are starting to look at the offerings that we have in our school as really the kind of knowledge that everybody should have to be prepared, to avert a catastrophe, and to be ready to react and respond should anything happen, not to have to rely so much on store-bought gadgets that, you know, may not be available if something, you know, catastrophic were to happen indeed.
Exactly. And also, I'm thinking, instead of just, I think a lot of people, when they do get into a situation where they're lost in the wilderness or some catastrophe has happened, they think, well, we just have to wait on somebody to rescue us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that can kill them, too. I mean, you know, because how long might it be before somebody rescues them? So they really need to know how to find water, how to make fire, how to make a shelter, and how to find food or, you know, medicine among the plants. So I'm just so thrilled to hear that more and more people are taking your classes.
Absolutely. I think the art of self-reliance for people of all ages and all genders, because I think, fortunately, we're breaking the stereotype that these things are no longer confined to men, but that as women, and we have a lot of very popular subjects where, you know, we have a lot of women's groups showing up precisely because they are the ones responsible for feeding their families, taking care of the medicinal needs of families, and so they're more looking into what's naturally available out there. And in habitats as rich as the ones we have here, where there are so many resources that are going to waste, people are starting to pay attention to, wow, how can I make a salve or a tincture, or how can I make medicine from this plant or from this herb instead of relying on the store-bought medicines that have all these chemicals and all these components that we cannot even pronounce because we don't even know what they are.
Yes, Yes, so much of what's on the market in the way of medicines has so many side effects that are deadly. Some of them are life-threatening. And so, yes, I think more and more people are wanting to get back to what's natural and what nature provided us with in the first place. Mm-hmm. So that's great. So you do teach classes on medicinal plants and edible plants, right?
Correct, yeah. A bulwark, if you will, of our classes, a mainstay, is the fact that we teach people about useful plants. My master's degree from Prescott College is in ethnobotany, and my master's thesis was on making fire by friction and uses of fire, primitive uses of fire in the Southwest. So certainly I would say if I have a specialty, it's ethnobotany, and that really opens up a whole world. Because, you know, when we take people out, and anybody, anywhere in the world, except, say, Africa, you take people out, you're not going to see a lot of wildlife often, but you are going to see a lot of plants. And many of those plants are either benign, or more importantly, they have edible uses, medicinal uses, shelter uses, fire uses. So really, when you say ethnobotany, you don't just mean medicinal and edible, though they are two of the more popular uses that people get interested in. And so when I talk about edible plants, we talk about not just can you eat it or not, but the importance of it. Was it a staple food? Was it a nibble? Nibbles, mind you, collectively can become an important food source in and of themselves. As far as medicinal plants go, we try to teach people the plants that are going to help you with everyday ailments, headaches, upset stomach, cuts and scrapes, okay, sore throat, congestion. Okay, urinary tract infections, that type of thing. So we don't get into the really serious stuff that would send you to, say, a naturopath or a proper doctor, but we do empower you to stay healthy from day to day with just the plants and the health living practices that we use, like proper breathing and posture and exercise and healthy eating, that collectively make you a healthy human being. And really, when you think about it, plants are at the epicenter of keeping healthy.
And we're also very big on teaching people about organic gardening and how to rehabilitate the land wherever they may live, and no matter how big or small the piece is, to be able to make it productive and to be able to grow their own food, because clearly there is nothing healthier and more wonderful than growing your own food and being able to fetch your own gardens and fruits from your orchard, as we are very lucky to do here in Raven's Nest. So those courses have become also very popular, because I think as people realize that their food is coming from countries very far away where they don't have the same strict FDA regulations, if you will, and they don't control as much the pesticides that go into the growing of those foods, people start to be more mindful as to where is their food coming from and what are the pesticides and the things to look for. And then they come to the natural conclusion that there's nothing healthier than growing your own food.
Absolutely. And I was just headed in that direction. I'm so glad you brought it up, because I think more and more people today are really looking at being able to grow their own food, whether they have to do it on their patio of the condo they're living in, or whether they've got, you know, some area of ground that they can actually, you know, plant. And I know you also teach about composting, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. And I'll let Claudia weigh in on this too, because she really, of the two of us, she's the more talented gardener. She has the green thumb. I'm more the harvester of the wild plants, though we both love gardening. I would say, you know, that composting here is an interesting prospect, because the whole idea, of course, is to create a very hot, moist situation in which plants decompose with the help of various invertebrates and microorganisms like fungi and bacteria. Well, moist is not, I think, synonymous with most habitats in Arizona, including the grasslands and mesquite woodlands that we're in. So what I found right off the bat, as opposed to some of the compost piles I managed up in New England and such back in the Northeast, is that I bury it in the ground. And what we do is we dig basically a grave for our ex-food or food scraps, and we bury it, cover it with some straw, just a little bit from straw bales. And what happens is, year-round, we get beetle larvae and other invertebrates in there that do the turning of the food for us. And so magically, we put it in the ground, cover it, maybe occasionally water it, though usually not. It stays pretty moist down in there as opposed to a raised one. the beetle larvae, and I'll turn it over, as I say, and magically, you're transforming basically sand, a very infertile soil for vegetables and crops, into a rich humus-like arrangement, more reminiscent of the woods back east. And so really, it's this wonderful process that gives you a head start on gardening here, because we do garden down below by our physical school, and we're planning on putting some raised beds up by our orchard as well. But the plots down by the school, they just are depauperate soil unless you enrich them. Now, the second source of compost that we have, in addition to what we create with our food scraps and such, and food scraps from our groups as well, is the organic waste that winds up at the terminus of various floods here. So we're in a mesquite woodland or bosque in the local lingo, and when you get flooding across it, at the very end of the flood, when it starts to recede, you get a lot of plant debris, really fine and mulched and moist, deposited, sometimes feet thick in a good year.
Wow.
And that is exactly what some of the natives used to use for their own gardens in the region. So I'll get the wheelbarrow out, get the shovel out, put it in there, and then move it to the garden. And I think that's even better than the compost we produce from the ground.
But it's very rewarding to be able to use what other people in most other places consider garbage, and they actually throw it to the garbage. For us, it's a valuable, valuable commodity that goes into what we call a compost bucket, and from there into this hole in the ground that is our compost pile. So we treasure all the peels and all the leftovers of food. We don't eat meat, so that's very important to note that you should not put any meat scraps in your compost pile, because then that will attract animals. But in our case, this is easy because it's basically fruits and vegetables and, you know, leftover of those type of foods. And then in this process that Vincent just explained, it's very rewarding then for you to get out a very nutritious soil that is going to enrich, in our case, the orchard that we have with some native trees, fruit trees, and also our organic gardens. So a very rewarding process and a very intimate relationship with the land. And we have great pride in not producing any garbage. We don't have garbage collection at our nature sanctuary. We're very lucky to live in a 42-acre nature sanctuary by a lake. And it was a deliberate decision not to have garbage collection, precisely to force us either to compost or to reduce or to reuse and recycle whatever it is that we bring into this property. A wonderful exercise when you consider the piles and piles of garbage that people pull out every day, and where this garbage is then going to be piled in these garbage dumps, which from an ecological perspective, they're a total disaster.
Well, I'm impressed that you can do that, because I don't know how it happens. I live alone, and somehow I accumulate a lot of garbage that I have to put out twice a week. And I'm like, how can, you know, where is all this stuff coming from? How is it that just me, I can accumulate so much garbage? And yes, that's something I'll have to work on, training myself not to bring in anything that creates more garbage.
There is so much extra packaging. We're very mindful of making sure that the cartons or the plastics we can recycle. And then we reuse all the glass bottles in a very creative way at the school to store seeds and to make our tinctures and to store our salves. In an effort, indeed, to be very mindful of what it is that we discard, which winds up being very, very little.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful and inspiring, because I know it can be done. I just have to be a little more creative with what I do with things. But I do recycle everything I can.
And, So many things can be done, and at a small scale, and they really make such a big, big difference. For example, we are very much into rainwater harvesting, and of course, we have both a very active system that stores 20,000 gallons of rainwater during our rainy season, which is our monsoon season, very short-lived, but very important to us, because it is thanks to that rainwater that we store that we are then able to water these organic gardens that we've been talking about. And so that cycle of using the soil from our compost pile and then the water that we stored from the rain season, it's really wonderful. But you do not need to have a 20,000-gallon capacity to do that. I mean, they sell now gallons that people can put off of their roofs in all sizes and shapes and to feed all budgets. So it is possible to make these small changes and really to feel a connection to the land, even if you live in the city or if you live in a crowded neighborhood, that is very rewarding and that makes you feel that you're doing something to protect the earth and the environment.
Yes, yes. That's something that I think we're all having to come to grips with, because the amount of garbage that goes into the garbage, the landfills and all is just outrageous. I mean, it's just shameful.
And, well, if I may weigh in on that, I just wanted to add one thing in terms of basically reducing our waste to nil, and that is because we live in a fire-prone region and fire is actually healthy for the land around here, yet we don't want a big blaze to destroy everything. I've had to, by hand, both Claudia and I, with minor help at times from groups that are in here, clear a lot of brush, especially in spring, though I'm starting to do it this time of year as well. And with that excess brush, you see basically everyone who lives around us, which is very few people, mind you, but people in general, throwing that stuff out. And I'm thinking, wow, well, this is living debris here. It's too much to compost and too coarse for that. However, what we wound up doing wound up being a magnificent solution for a number of challenges that we have. The first and foremost, indeed, is clearing the brush so you don't have the fire hazard as extreme as before, especially around structures. Okay, so now I have piles of leaves and sticks and cacti and whatever, anything dead, from some parts of the land, and it gets really voluminous fast. Well, we have arroyos or dry stream beds going through Raven's Nest, our nature sanctuary, and I noticed right off the bat that one of them had big berms of sand on the side. And indeed, a nearby neighbor eventually informed us, well, hey, you know, you just bought that place that the arroyos were bulldozed to prevent flooding. And I thought to myself, wow, someone really wasn't very astute. A, that's illegal to do in our waterways, even if they're not perennial. And B, now you're going to have the water shoot through there really quickly and not water the trees, which is why we have a woodland here. And so I thought to myself, when in the world am I going to have the time to shovel sand back in the arroyo and make it more natural? Oh, bing, a light bulb went off over my head. Let's put the brush piles in the arroyo, cover them with the sand, batten them down with rebar and mesh, cover that so you can't see it. And now we've created habitat islands. So we cut down the fire hazard. We restored hydrology by cutting through those berms and allowing the water to spread out again. The berms we created, the habitat islands themselves, the water hits it in the arroyo and slows down and sinks into the ground, so it's passive rainwater harvesting. And as these habitat islands, we call them age, they become havens for things that live in the ground and also native wildflowers. So we've seen rodents of various types, say native mice and kangaroo rats and such, tarantulas, your favorite, moving in, and various things calling this home. So anytime we can, with one fell swoop, benefit the environment and ourselves so much, it's definitely a plus, and it happened to be that way with these habitat islands.
Oh, that was brilliant. That was a brilliant idea. Wow.
It helped tremendously.
Oh, Claudia, before I go ahead, on the organic gardening, are you doing anything in the way of, like, permaculture?
Yes, we are. We have designed the gardens to be very efficient, to benefit from some of the passive rainwater harvesting features that we have put in. We have planted trees, native fruit trees, to be able to give shade over these gardens. Or we have planted the gardens under existing mesquite trees to be able to benefit from the amazing debris that the mesquites release, which happens to be an excellent composting material. All the dry leaves and all the nitrogen and the nutrients released from the tree are very good for the soil, and they enrich the soil below. And always very mindful of the orientation vis-a-vis the sun, so that, you know, they don't get, because here we have such amazing hot temperatures, so that they are naturally shielded and, you know, as best protected from the wind and the elements, if you will. So the combination of the rainwater harvesting and all of these factors when we grow our gardens have led to very successful formula, because when we moved in to this beautiful place 5 years ago, it was a sandy soil and a very barren sandy soil. And this area that we selected had actually been used around a horse barn. And so it had been overgrazed and it was really in very bad shape. And with all these practices, all these earth stewardship practices, we were able to rehabilitate this land and this soil to where now we have even strawberries growing, tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, all sorts of watermelons, squashes, chilies. It's been very, very rewarding to see how the land responds to this, you know, concerted effort, if you will, and always planting native seeds. We're very much into seed selection because we believe that this land here should receive the type of seeds that it has grown and it's accustomed to growing, rather than importing species from other areas and, you know, doing a disservice to the land in that way. And we're very much into native species of all types to attract the native insects and attract the native pollinators and so forth. And so it has been a very slow and I would say a very intense process, but the results are amazing and very productive gardens, despite the challenges that we have, which are extreme heat, extreme sun, very windy conditions at times, and of course the inevitable plagues that we have at certain times of the year, like grasshoppers, which are impossible to avoid. And so, you know, they come and they very quickly decimate the garden, but it's part of the cycle. So we have learned to cope and weather the storm, if you will. But the rewards throughout the year are just amazing, both at the organic gardens and at our organic orchard. Also, a lot of effort has gone into protecting those trees. But it's amazing how we were able to collect pomegranates and peaches and apricots from, you know, relatively young trees. But they also show the care and they're responding to the fact that we have done the passive rainwater harvesting, that Vincent was very mindful in the way he planted them in groups so that they will all, you know, collectively protect themselves from the wind and the sun and shade each other. And so, you know, it's been a very intense but also very rewarding process.
Yeah, and when you think of permaculture, what leaps to mind definitely is exactly what Claudia said, are the mesquite trees here, because we do live in a mesquite bosque, though there are catclaw acacias here as well. Well, both species intersperse themselves throughout our organic orchard, which is up high and near our house, as opposed to the school, which is down low in the sandy soil. So up by the house and in the orchard, you have clay soils, which is quite different than the sandy soils. And they want to grow mesquite trees, albeit smaller than the ones below. Well, we noticed that it was the densest patch of little mesquite woodland up by the house is where we chose to put in the organic orchard, exactly for the nutrients that you get from the nitrogenous waste from the leaves, since being a legume, as with many other species in the Fabaceae, the bean family, the roots have nitrogen-fixing bacteria that take atmospheric nitrogen and make it available to plants. So the mesquite uses that. It's very nitrogen-rich. And when the leaves fall, say in winter, it rains down this nitrogenous waste available to other plants. Well, now it's raining down upon the peaches and pomegranates and apricots, et cetera, of the world in our orchard. So it's really this wonderful cycle. And not only that, you have the wind protection, the shade from it, and because we're watering, you know, with the rainwater, the orchard trees, the mesquites nearby also get watered. They get taller, and it's a positive feedback system. And finally, we harvest the mesquite pods themselves, which are a native species but give a delicious product.
Oh, yes. I know Native American used some of the mesquite. They made flour with it, I believe.
Exactly. Delicious pancakes and delicious recipes come out from the mesquite flour.
Wow. Do you have a recipe book for these things?
We don't have a recipe book per se. It's basically all in our heads. But one of my favorite things to do with mesquite pods is quite simple. You break up the pod so there's more surface area, and you get the fattest, most delicious ones by sampling a variety of mesquite trees, all the same species. But just like you might sample fruit in the store, you're going to take the batch that tastes the best. Well, we do the same. But you basically break it down, barely covered in water in a pan, and then bring that to a simmer for a long time. And then you're going to drain that and save it, put more water over the same pods, do the same thing again, and then your water now, minus the pods, gets simmered down into a syrup that is almost a dead ringer for molasses. It's delicious.
Really?
Yes,
oh, my goodness.
Incredible.
That is fascinating. I had no idea. You really need to put together a book on how to harvest and how to prepare all these different wild edibles that are out there.
I am.
In fact, I'm maybe about
90% done, so I'm very close, a book on the ethnobotany and useful plants of the Sky Islands. And the reason I'm putting it together is the fact that that book doesn't exist out there. There are decent edible plant books to certain parts of the country. I know one, for instance, to the Northwest that's fairly decent, also one to the Midwest. But to our region, which actually has far more edible plants than those two regions combined, most likely, there really is not a great guide, nothing in depth, and nothing speaking from the author's personal experiences. Because what you find in the wild edible plant literature across at least the United States is that you'll often get recycled information from a publication decades and decades ago, and even that publication might not have been from direct information by the author. So you play telephone, and when you're ingesting plants, that can be a dangerous gambit indeed. So what we're trying to do is put fresh information out there and say, yes, so-and-so said, but more importantly, I tried this dozens and dozens of times, and I proved that it works this way. And the thing about our book is it's not only to edible plants and medicinal plants. I have 22 use categories for plants. So we're talking music even, and glues, and smoke, and incenses, and shelter materials, fire making, etc. So, you know, it's like opening Pandora's box in a good way when you get into these various useful plants.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Absolutely fabulous. When do you think you'll have that book ready?
You know, I'm hoping to have it done within the next 6 months. The problem is there are so many useful plants here, I keep adding them to the book and adding chapters. So at some point you have to say, it's good enough. I'll never have everything I want in it. But I am adding a little more information just to make it that much better. But hopefully within 6 months.
Oh, that sounds great. I can't wait for it to come out. I'll buy. And I want to show again. Please tell people how they can reach you and a little bit about what they need to do if they want to enroll in some of your classes.
Well, you know, the best and surest way is to call or email us. We're very approachable. While we're super busy teaching all the time, we check our emails and phone messages regularly, and we would love to hear from people. And our favorite way for people to interact with us is to custom make a class in which you call or email us, tell us how many people you want to bring, what you would like to learn, and give us your ideal dream class. And then we're going to put together an outline for you that basically we're going to haggle back and forth till you have exactly what you want. And we're going to custom make a program for you. We suggest multi-day programs so that people can get the most out of it and really immerse themselves and be in depth. However, we also do half-day and day programs. And people also, if they just want to take an existing program, can look online at www.ravensnatureschool.com. That's ravensnatureschool.com. And that's a great way to see the breadth of classes that we offer, because we do joke with people. We cast a very wide net. And the reason is we can't read your mind. We don't know what will get you interested in nature or what already interests you. So we're going to try to cover a lot of it and do it well as well. So, you know, really, that's the best way to get in touch with us.
That's wonderful. Well, I had been thinking that I would like to bring several members of my family down as a group to take a course that would last several days, and they would learn many of these techniques. So we can set up something like that then.
Exactly. That's the ideal way to approach it. Why? Because as opposed to our existing classes where, you know, there's a set program and a set length, we can be very flexible. We can interweave topics that otherwise we might not put together in an existing program. And it speaks to exactly what you want to learn. And we love working with families. And the reason is you get different ages and different genders. And you know, somebody's always getting it. If everybody doesn't get it, somebody will get it. And it will be passed on. Because really it becomes about traditions then, generational traditions. And that's what we're trying to do, is keep these ideas and this love of nature alive for the benefit of the planet, really, is what it comes down to.
And to add to this wonderful learning experience, people can stay at our African-style safari tented camp. We have basically built a beautiful safari camp to allow people to stay and sleep over in canvas tents that are fully furnished, very comfortable, that have their own private bathrooms with incinerator toilets, hot showers, and basically built in a very ecological manner around and in, woven between our mesquite bosque. So it's a very secluded, very quiet, and very relaxing experience at our 42-acre nature sanctuary by Patagonia Lake, while at the same time being very, very inspirational, because from Vincent they're going to be learning from a very early birding class in the morning, if people are interested in birding, to a very late astronomy class, because we have beautiful dark skies in Arizona. And so the experience can be custom made to accommodate as many topics as people will be interested in, and being able to stay here on site with us.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, and I look forward to planning a class with you sometime in the near future. And for all my listeners out there, you know how to reach them. And when you go online and look at their website, you will fall in love all over again with Mother Earth. They have some of the most beautiful photographs on there of their habitats and the flowers and the birds and the wildness and the beauty of it. So do look at Raven's Way Wild Journeys, Raven's Way Nature School. There are many ways to pull that up, and it is worth $1 million to see that site. So until my next show, may the sun kiss your face, may the waters bless your body, and may all nature sing in your presence.
Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you.
Thank you.